Ted Russin is the Associate Dean of Culinary Science at the Culinary Institute of America. He oversees the college's baccalaureate degree program in culinary science and is responsible for the curriculum, instruction, and program development for the entire academic major. He's also an instructor for the Culinary Research and Development Ingredient Functionality courses in the program.
And a very good guest on Food Friday on WAMC. Mr. Russin was host and creative development consultant for the Cooking Channel special Geekalicious in 2011 and a consulting expert and editor for the Gels, Thickeners, and Foams chapter in Nathan Marvold's groundbreaking book, Modernistic Cuisine.
So, how is science of food different from the art of cooking, and how does one get those ingredients to function? That is why Ted is here, and we welcome him to the program. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here.
Very nice to have you with us. So what is, tell us about how you got into this.
Into this racket.
Yes. Is it a racket?
It's not a racket. It's a vocation.
Okay.
That's what it is. It's been a long, winding road. I actually, when I first graduated from high school, I went into an undergraduate degree in philosophy. And seeing how lucrative that was,
Where'd you do that?
That was up in Canada. I'm from Canada originally, so I did that at the University of Winnipeg. And then at the end of that degree, I decided to take a more practical turn. I went to culinary school and worked in a few restaurants and came to realize that life was not particularly sustainable. And then I went back to school and did an undergraduate and graduate degree in food science and agricultural chemistry.
Now, when you say not sustainable when you were working in the restaurants, there's a potential for trouble for you. What happened?
To be quite frank, and I think you've heard it here this morning, that the culinary world as a vocation and as a career is a challenging workplace.
You bet.
The hours are long. The pay is what it is. And it's a true passion more than anything, I think. Mm-hmm. And for me at the time, I remember looking at in the restaurants I was working in and looking at the people that were more senior and seeing the lifestyle they had. And it just didn't sort of suit my personality.
So you're here with your wife and your baby. So I have to ask you something. Who cooks at home?
Well, my baby's only 1 year old, so
she has some motor skills. She's out.
She's very good at emptying the pantry. She's very good at that. But my wife actually is a dietitian by training, so she does the bulk of the cooking at home. However, we do enjoy it. It brings us together as a couple, which is always good. But we do eat very healthy, very healthy.
So, talk to us a little bit about what you like the students to come away knowing when it comes to this idea of science and food.
Well, things have changed over the last 10 to 20 years, I would say. There's been Alan mentioned Modernist Cuisine, that book. There's been a groundswell of chefs all around the globe using technical approaches to their cuisine. Instead of thinking generally about, I need to cook this piece of meat in an oven at this general temperature, they're saying and suggesting that it needs to be cooked to this particular temperature. I need it to be 62 or 64 degrees Celsius, because that's the ultimate sensory experience for this particular cut of meat. And the tools that have made their way into the kitchen over the last 20 years have allowed them to have that kind of precision and that kind of approach to the foods that they're making. That spirit of being precise, that spirit of saying, I have a food ingredient, I pay good money for this ingredient. Mm-hmm. I want to ensure that I bring the most out of this ingredient. That spirit of attention to detail is part of the very essence of our program, is to be able to say, to ask a question, to say, what is this? How does it function? And ultimately get the most out of it efficiently as well as from a sensorial.
What's a good ingredient to use as an example?
Well, I would say one of the big more modern techniques that sort of grew out of laboratory equipment. In the lab, you essentially monitor chemical reactions, and chemical reactions at particular temperatures at which they're optimum. And there was equipment designed to basically set a water bath to say, I know that this particular enzyme works at 53 degrees. It's optimal there, the highest activity.
Sure.
So this equipment was initially designed for the lab, and that equipment migrated to the culinary environment over the last 10, 15, 20 years, and now chefs are using that to say, I have a chicken breast. I know that a chicken breast cooked at 61.3 degrees Celsius is more delicious, and the texture is more moist than a chicken breast at 62 degrees Celsius. So they'll vacuum pack the piece of meat, they'll drop it into their water bath, and then they will hold it for a particular time temperature combination to ensure it's safe for consumption, and ultimately come away with a piece of meat that they feel is optimal. As opposed to, you know, you could cook a chicken breast, you saute it traditionally, and you put it in the oven to bake through. You can certainly do that, and that's how I was taught in culinary school. But now things have changed. You could still do that technique, and I've had delicious food prepared that way. But I've also had delicious food prepared in a way, in a much more precise, premeditated, sort of specific and particular fashion.
I just got an email saying, ask him about GMOs.
Okay. So I'm asking about GMOs.
It was a big controversy. Should it be labeled? Should it be allowed? You're a guy who deals with science.
Yes.
And what's the science of this?
Okay. Well, I'll sort of soften my perspective, or give some background with regards to this. I'm a chemist, so I'm sort of copping out of this a little bit. I'm not a molecular biologist by any chance, and I'm not a regulatory or toxicologist. So I've kind of stepped back from making sort of nutritional claims like that. However, I think that, and part of my approach to foods in general, in particular with my ingredient functionality class, is to fully understand what you're working with. And I think, you know, I'm all for transparency.
Sure.
You know, I have no problem with people knowing full well how their foods were produced, why they were produced in a particular way, and ultimately what benefits that food provides. So with regards to GMO labeling, I don't have a problem with that. I feel that that kind of transparency is absolutely necessary.
Well, I agree with you about the labeling, mm-hmm. but I want to ask you a more complicated question. A GMO is bad?
I would say that, you know, I grew up in Canada. I grew up on the prairies of Canada.
Sure.
So you have Manitoba, Alberta, and Saskatchewan. You have these the Chernozem soil, this rich agricultural area. And at the time when I was in agriculture school, Roundup was making its way, these sort of these particular herbicides combined with particular genetically modified crops, and it was a very big sort of commercial push, to be quite frank. That was about 20 years ago, and we're seeing ecologies change. We're seeing herbs or sort of weeds that are becoming resistant. We're seeing this. These are very complicated biological systems, and I'll be quite honest with you, the type of chemistry and type of food science I do, it only deals with dead things, so I kind of get my cop out that way. But it is, I feel that these are very, very complicated systems, and I think there can be consequences that may be unpredictable. But I would say that that goes with absolutely everything you do.
Have you been surprised about the vehemence with which the opponents of GMOs have spoken?
You know, the only thing that I would suggest is that people... And this is what we teach our students here at the college, particularly in the culinary science program. What we want to have is scientifically literate culinarians.
Sure.
So we don't encourage them discussing anecdotal evidence. We don't encourage them to just scour the internet and find the first hit that says the word whatever, disease or calamity, and say that that's the evidence. What we do encourage them to do is to go to the literature and have a critical approach to it and see what is true and what is false, how much evidence there is there even enough evidence to make a judgment? And that's that kind of critical thinking skill is what we're really trying to teach our students. And ultimately, these students, and I was listening to the sessions you had earlier, that and I think it was Deirdre that mentioned that our students are feeding people. So we want the people that are feeding essentially everybody to have a critical approach to food, to fully understand it as opposed to just taking anecdotes and hearsay as gospel.
When the students leave your program, you want them to have an appreciation of what, I guess my ultimate question is how they integrate it into everything else they've been learning.
Absolutely. So in the program itself, you start with 2 years of the associate's degree, which is essentially the culinary arts or baking pastry degree that everybody comes here for the college to get. Once they've completed that associate's degree, then they enter the bachelor's program. This program is cumulative. It builds on that initial culinary or baking pastry experience, but it is, again, designed to foster critical thinking and critical learning, and ultimately give them the strength and capabilities to deal with problems. Science is a scientific approach or a rational approach, evidence-based approach, is essentially a problem-solving tool. That's all it is. We tell the students more than once that we are in an environment of controlled failure, because ultimately science is essentially that. You want to put up a question, you want to create a test for that, and if you fail, that's fine. You have to have a particular psychological perspective and makeup in order to get over these failures, because it can be a little disheartening over time. But nonetheless, These students, when they go through the program, they learn all about how heat transfers through food, so they understand the physics of food. They come to ferment things. They come to understand the microbial ecology of the kitchen. They, you know, my class in ingredient functionality, I co-teach that with Chef Louis. We spend time essentially saying, what have you done for me lately? You have all these ingredients in your mise en place staring at you. What are they doing, and why are they even there?
Mm.
So at the end of the program, the students even do a senior thesis where they basically... And I'm certain you both have questions that keep you up at night about food. Who doesn't?
Absolutely.
Right? So you just say to yourself, this is the chance for the students to stay. I can stare deeply into my navel, and I can try to figure out what effect the type of flour is used in a cookie, and what effect that has on texture. That was one of the students' projects we did. Another student project was focused on lime juice and trying to get the most lime juice out of a lime. Because they've been a lot of hearsay all over the place. You should roll your limes. You should warm your limes. You should cool your limes.
And the answer was?
The answer was actually rolling the lime causes a bunch of sort of cellular, it breaks down the cells, so it allows for more liquid to be released. It releases some of the flavor oils, essential oils that are found on the, in the actual peel.
With the stuff on it or not?
So you haven't peeled it at all. Yeah. So you just roll it and then you'll slice it. And you're releasing essential oils, you're releasing volatile compounds, you're breaking down plant cells, and you're just getting a lot of liquid there. Oh. So you can increase recovery and you can increase flavor as well.
I'm going home to do that.
Well,
that's,
you know,
very cool.
You never know. Maybe you'll make yourself a key lime pie or something like it. Maybe delicious.
Is that what comes out of that when you do that? A key lime pie? Even though it's 11?
Yeah, you know, I've never rubbed and rolled a lime long enough to get a key lime pie out of it, perhaps. I don't know.
So that's a phrase I don't think has ever been spoken on the program before. I haven't rolled long.
This is why you've come to the CIA.
Indeed it is.
Tell me about Geekalicious.
Geekalicious was a television program it was developed. I initially was solicited by the company that makes the production company that produces MythBusters.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. They're on Discovery Channel, and they are sort of a science-based, sort of empirically based production company. And they approached me to do a series on food. And it took a long time to develop this. It eventually got pitched to different networks, and it got picked up for a pilot at the Cooking Channel.
But
and
why
the,
you? Why would me? They say you were part of Geekalicious? You don't look like a geek.
Well, I am wearing a lab coat. That doesn't help.
Yeah, you got glasses on.
I do have glasses, yes. My mother would say I'm not a geek. I don't think so.
No, your mother would.
Well, you think so?
Yeah,
no, I
mean, sure.
That's a mother's love. So I think what it was the challenge of taking technical information and creating and translating it in such a way that it's accessible to people.
Yeah.
Because, for example, we started talking about GMOs. There is a huge microbial genetics discussion around that, and there's a massive political discussion around that,
sure.
And there's a massive economic discussion around that. And these people live in their own little jargon worlds, and it's hard to kind of intercommunicate. And I think part of the strength I brought to the television program was to kind of say, listen, we're making a souffle, and I can talk all about alpha albumin being denatured and hydrophobic and hydrophobicity and all these type of chemical terms, but I can also say we need to beat this because we're turning them inside out, and people need, that's why we get air into the system, and that's why it's stable.
Hydrophobic,
yes. Hydrophobic. So phobic. You have maybe, perhaps, Alan, you have some phobias.
Perhaps.
Hydrophobic is afraid of water.
Yeah.
So if you think of something, what's an ingredient that would be afraid of water in the kitchen?
Afraid of water in the kitchen?
Yeah.
The sink.
Well, no, the sink likes, well, in a way, that's true. It is a basin that doesn't dissolve when you put water in it. But oil is the ultimate.
Oil and water.
Oil and water, right?
Yeah.
They don't mix.
We can force them to spend some time together, but we can't get them to completely intermingle to the end of time.
Boy.
And with that... We leave you thinking this morning. Ted Russin is the Associate Dean of Culinary Science at the Culinary Institute of America. Ted, thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure.
You were terrific.
Very cool.
Thank you so
much.
Lots
of fun. Thank you.
Enjoyed my time.
You're listening to the Roundtable's live broadcast from the CIA on WAMC.